intended to arrange to his satisfaction. My father used his life, his talent, and his fortune to secure the rights of men to control their own destinies, and he still intended to command his. He'd decided to die, and nothing could discourage him, not even my cry of pure anguish when he ordered his coffin be made. After that, my whole world reduced to the intervals of wakefulness and consciousness between my father's slumber. I shuddered when he said, "Take heart, Patsy. Jeff has promised to never abandon you. And when I'm gone, you'll find within that drawer," he said, spending his precious strength to point to it, "a little casket of gifts for you." The pain that swept through me in anticipation of the end was nothing I'd ever experienced before, even for all the other losses. Nothing I thought I could survive. Even the thought of losing my father was a crushing, grinding agony of the spirit that left me not just shuddering, but quaking in its wake. "No, Papa, not yet."
"Not yet," he agreed, taking shallow, rasping breaths upon his pillow. "I want to breathe my last on that great day, the birthday of my country."
July the 4th, he meant. The 50th anniversary of our independence. The day he became the most profound voice of his age. Of any age.
"Mother, let us relieve your vigil,"
Jeff insisted, his comforting hand upon my shoulder.
"We'll stay with him all night. We'll drag in pallets so that he's never alone for a moment, if only you'll get some rest."
I couldn't consent to it, especially not when Sally sat so resolutely, her spine straight upon a wooden chair nearby. I don't know what words of farewell she exchanged with Papa. What they'd shielded from the world all their lives, they still kept, with possessive silence, to themselves. And I had to be coaxed away from my father's sick bed like a lamed animal to water. So violent was my own pain at the expectation of him being torn from me, I had to be pried away. Until, at long last, on the 3rd of July, my father's suffering seemed to demand a wish for the end. Struggling for breath, Papa would ask,
"Is it the 4th?
Because we couldn't bear for him to perish with even one more disappointment, we told him it was. An expression came over his countenance that my children naively believed to mean,
"Just as I wished."
But I don't believe my father was deceived. Even after his limbs took on the clamminess of death, and his pulse was so faint only the doctor could feel it, Papa stirred again to ask,
"Is it the 4th?
This time the doctor said,
"It soon shall be."
I stared at the clock, willing the hands to move, wishing I had my father's indomitable will to shape the world and make the laws of the universe bend. Gladly would I give up a day of my own life, a day from the lives of everyone living, to deliver my father into the morning of his glorious 4th. But the physician said softly,
"He has no more than 15 minutes now."
An hour later, my father was still alive and refused his laudanum. He then fell back into a disturbed sleep, and in a vivid dream, he roused himself, anxiously gesturing with his hands as if to write upon a tablet,
"The Committee of Safety ought to be warned."
My children wondered what he could be dreaming about. I didn't have to wonder. I knew. He was, in his final breaths, readying for the British invasion, readying to fight the war for independence all over again.
We'd later learn that in Quincy, Massachusetts, John Adams was also on his deathbed, equally determined to see the morning of the 4th. He'd die on the cherished day, my father's name on his lips. But all we knew was that in Virginia, the struggle went on and on. My papa's frail chest rose and fell under the obelisk clock that ticked the interminable stretch. Mr. Short had that clock made for papa, and in remembering that, it seemed as if William, too, was hovering over papa in vigil. Burwell helped to arrange papa's head upon his pillow. Jeff swept his lips with a wet sponge, which my father sucked and appeared to relish. Just a few more hours, I thought, until the 4th. And I turned to see Sally, too, straining to see the hands of that same clock move. When the clock finally struck midnight, sighs of relief exploded around us, and upon seeing the faint breath of my papa upon a glass held to his lips, I felt a grim satisfaction, like a commander upon a battlefield who has seen a victory. But papa didn't leave this victory to chance. He soldiered on until noon, when, with eyes wide in apprehension of his triumph, he ceased to breathe. That moment, for me, was an eclipse of the sun, a blackening of the whole earth, an unfathomable grief in which I no longer knew myself, or the world, or my place in it. But my father, who had always known his place in that world, passed like the hero he was, from life into legend. On Mulberry Row, a white sheet draped over a thorn bush, flapping ghostly in a light summer breeze to signal to neighboring farms that my father was dead. In the carpentry shop, Madison and Eston helped their uncle sand the rough edges of Papa's wooden coffin. On the western side of the mountain, slaves dug the grave. And I did nothing. Numb with grief, overwhelmed by loss, I couldn't seem to catch my breath. "Take some fresh air," one of my children said. I don't know which one. I was blind and deaf to everything. I couldn't feel my limbs. All I felt was the slow calcification inside me, spreading so that I couldn't move. Someone grasped me at the elbows to prompt me outside onto the terrace. Someone else called for the doctor to tend me. And it was there, on the terrace, in the most acute distress, that I heard the pounding of horse hooves. "Papa," I thought. Was he riding hard upon Caractacus, as he loved to do in his youth? Then the vision swam before my eyes, not of my father, but of my husband. Tom, in his youth, a young and handsome horseman, riding up the road toward our house. I blinked, and the vision came clear. It was Tom, no longer young or beautiful, but still riding like a demon. Where he'd gotten the horse, I didn't know. Nevertheless, my husband swung down from the saddle of a frothing, pawing animal. "Is he dead?" At my elbow, the doctor nodded. "Mr. Jefferson expired a quarter after noon." To hear it said again, I nearly stumbled. Behind me, the children must have gathered, because I heard little George blubber, while Septimia choked out tiny, delicate sobs. "Grandpapa is gone."
"You poor children," Tom said, a light in his eyes strangely fueled by the sight of our misery. "Look how grieved you are to lose him. But not your mother. Her eyes are dry as always. Can't you shed a tear, Martha? Not even for your father."
The physician stiffened at my side.
Colonel Randolph.
Colonel Randolph. He was entitled to be called that, of course, but I could only think of his father. That's who Tom had become, a miserable old rotter like the one who begat him. Tom advanced upon me in a scatter of flies.
Don't you think it's unnatural for such a devoted daughter to lose her father without even a tear? And Thomas Jefferson, no less, a great man that the whole of the country will mourn, but not his own daughter.
The doctor barked again.
Colonel Randolph.
All that escaped me was a tiny keening sound, and my husband's face twisted in feigned concern.
Don't you see, doctor? She can't cry. My wife must be suffering from a morbid condition. Won't you prescribe some medicine to cure her?
The outraged physician said,
"The medicine she needs is quiet, sir."
The admonishment did nothing to dissuade Tom. In fact, a maniacal grin broke over his face.
Quiet? Oh, yes, by all means, give her quiet. All the country will be firing cannons, tolling bells, and wailing in grief, but Martha will quietly go on. She'll quietly persevere. She has ice water for blood.
Enough, Tom, I finally said, all the emptiness my father had left filling up with a terrible rage. That my husband had descended into madness was without question, but I was sure to follow him there if I let this go on today of all days.
You don't tell me what's enough.
Then he began working the muscles of his face, spasming and contracting them as if to manufacture the sudden tears that swept down his cheeks.
I know you won't mourn me when I'm dead, but I thought you might be able to muster a tear for the only man you really loved.
Tom sobbed, howling as if to mock me,
and I loved him. He was my father, too, and I loved him. You hated him.
Jeff snarled, having come out of the house with a bang of the door to encounter this scene.
You hated my grandfather in life, and you neglected him in death. You're only here to harangue my mother like some scavenging beast over the corpse. You're more ferocious than a wolf and more fell than a hyena.
Jeff put himself between his father and me. The other boys drove my husband off, but I knew he'd be back again for the funeral. It was open to the public, so we couldn't keep him away. I knew there'd be talk, whether because my lunatic husband was absent or because he was there. There was nothing for it, and I was scarcely sensible enough to care. My world was shattered. The loss I felt unfathomable, and it wasn't just my own loss, for my father belonged to the people, perhaps now more than ever. The bells had tolled for my father's death, and the townspeople closed the city. Donning black armbands, they formed a processional up the mountain that was delayed by the rain. While we waited for people to arrive on the dismal and dreary day, Sally and I stood on either side of the open grave, Papa's coffin between us, held up on planks. Huddling with her enslaved family against the rain, Sally wore a plain black dress with the locket my father had given her long ago. Her eyes trained not on the coffin, but on me. She must have known her fate now rested in my hands. But there was nothing servile in her expression, only an expectation of justice. She seemed to believe herself a free woman, and didn't lower her eyes in deference, not even for Tom, when he appeared to taunt us.
Here are his two widows, and neither of them shedding a tear.
In that moment, I wished Tom straight to hell and believed Sally did the same.
Let's start,
Jeff finally said, fearing my husband wanted witnesses to cause a scene. He wasn't wrong. Tom quarreled with him that we ought to delay on account of the rain, then held himself over Papa's coffin, wailing in affected grief, while I looked on like a statue in the driving rain.
"You've got a heart of stone,"
Tom shouted at me. But his words didn't pierce me. He was right. Until that moment, I believed my heart was flesh and blood like any other. But my heart had turned to stone. The sky itself might cry, but I wouldn't. My tears, when they came, if they came, wouldn't be for Tom. All my life I'd held back my tears. For my father's sanity, for his reputation, and now for his legacy. However much I wished for release, for a moment to feel the loss, no one would ever see me fall to pieces. No one would ever see that. Certainly not Tom Randolph. So I endured his taunts. I endured the shoveling of dirt over my father's grave, and I endured the silence that followed. Our silence. Our special silence. Others would suffer, truly suffer, for what my father hadn't said in his lifetime. But I'd always divined his wishes in that silence, and could hear his words echoing in it even now. And those words were, "Take care of me when I'm dead." Chapter 42. Monticello, unknown date. From Thomas Jefferson to Martha Jefferson Randolph.
Farewell, my dear, my loved daughter, adieu. The last pang of life is in parting from you. Two seraphs await me, long shrouded in death. I will bear them your love on my last parting breath.
This is his last letter. I read it often, wondering sometimes if he left one like it for Sally. If there are letters, tokens, evidence, well, she has good reason to keep them quiet. Along with the linens, the artwork, the furniture, and the rest of the slaves at Monticello, she's been priced for auction. Her value has been set at $50. But she won't be sold with everything else. On the night we buried my father, we faced one another in Papa's chambers, and she gave me the keys she'd claimed as her own for decades. She surrendered to me her dominion over my father's private sanctuary and her place in his life. She hadn't bargained for her freedom in France, only for the freedom of her children. But she will have her freedom. I'll see to that. I'll let her walk off this mountain like Harriet and Beverly did. She'll be given her time. And her silence is the price. I make Jeff swear upon God and country and his honor as a Virginia gentleman, and upon his grandfather's honor too, that Sally will not be sold. He doesn't ask me why. My son knows better than to ask. I wouldn't tell him the truth anyway. If it comes to it, I will lie about Sally to my deathbed. But in exchange for Jeff's vow, he demands that I make one of my own. I must agree not to witness the rest of the slaves being auctioned off at Monticello. I feel as if I should be there, as if I must witness the final destruction of everything, as if I need to see every tear as my father's people are ripped away from their mountain, from the only home they've ever known. I ought to hear their sobbing as the auctioneer calls out their worth. But Jeff says,
"It's making you sick."
I am sick now, but shall be well again. Because I have to be. My work, my father's work, remains undone. And as with Anne's death, I must hold myself together until I've finished doing for my father the very last thing that I can do for him in this world. Jeff puts a hand on my shoulder.
Spare yourself the bitter anguish of seeing his abode rendered desolate, the walls dismantled, and his bedroom violated by the auctioneer, and take the children before my father snatches them from you.
Perhaps he fears that in my grief I'll become as unhinged as his father,
whereas what I fear is his father.
I am uniquely vulnerable to Tom as I never was before in our marriage. I am his wife, and he has dominion over me, without having to answer to Thomas Jefferson. His conduct at the funeral is proof enough of his intentions. He will come for me now, either to claim me or tear the children away. The law would say I must submit to him. The scriptures command it. But I do not wait to lower my head meekly and do what is expected of me. Not after all I've seen and lived through. No, I do not stay to see the slave auction and wait for the whirlwind of Tom's wrath to come down on my head. Instead, I pack up the children swiftly and take them to Boston. There are no slaves in Boston. There's more housewifery to do because the servants are unreliable, Ellen complains, showing me about her luxurious new home on Beacon Hill. They're lazy because they know they can leave any time for better wages or any reason at all. Why, I've gone through 3 cooks in the past 6 months. But I cannot wish to ever return to a slave state.
You should never.
I catch myself by surprise with my vehemence. Land and Negroes in Virginia are to 9 persons out of 10 certain ruin and a vexation of the spirit that wearies one of life itself. And I am weary of life. I've really suffered so much that I cannot comprehend the possibility of better days. Consumed by despair, every morning is a struggle to get out of bed. I do it for the people yet depending on me, while I depend upon Ellen. She does everything in her power to cheer me. She shows me the city, which has grown enormously since I was here with my father as a little girl. Everywhere I look now is perfect luxury and wealth. The stately homes, though all squeezed together, are unimaginably well furnished. In Ellen's house, I wash my feet each morning in a plain basin that costs at least $30, and the water's deep enough I might take a swim. The dining table glitters with cut glass and silver, and surrounded by such wealth, I'm consumed with guilt for the discomfort in which I left the rest of my family at Monticello. We celebrate Christmas with trips to the theater and visits. Ellen arranges a party in an oval drawing room with paintings, silk damask curtains, and carved mahogany chairs. We dine on oysters and lobsters and other bounties of the sea. There's ice cream and every variety of cake in silver baskets. And people keep asking how it is that my father, remembered for his responsible management of the nation's finances, could have died in penury and embarrassment. And I always reply, his public virtue was the cause, if you should call that an embarrassment. I never shall be ashamed of an honorable poverty. It's the price we've paid for a long and useful life devoted to the service of this country. Ellen owlishly watches my every move, so I smile for her sake. Until my father's debts are extinguished, I have no income but the monies earned by my servants, who have all hired themselves out in Virginia. Their wages won't be enough. Until a sale of my father's papers can be arranged, I'm now, like Nancy Randolph once was, utterly at the mercy of my relations and their goodwill. So I don't dare object when Ellen's husband enrolls Septimia and George in school. The children behave well enough there,
It's only when they return home that they give themselves over to the Randolph, bickering like children who have no reason to know how precarious our circumstances are. My older children know. When it becomes clear that the lottery will be cancelled, Cornelia writes bitterly, "It's over then. After 60 years of devoted services, his children are left in beggary by the country to whom he had bequeathed them." Ellen impresses upon me that I have no choice but to stay in Boston. "Live with us, you and the children together. My husband rented a place for you in Cambridge so as not to crowd this house. We'll send for Mary and Cornelia and see them married off well." It's a generous offer, but it makes me uneasy to be a burden to Ellen's husband, who is already worrying about overcrowding the house. Ellen mistakes my hesitation, holding tight to my hand. "I know it pains you to leave Virginia, but I fear there are no ties which should bind any descendants of Thomas Jefferson to the state any longer." She's echoing the sentiments of my sister's son, Francis. Polly's precious boy wrote with bitterness over our plight, arguing that the liberality and generosity and patriotism of the Old Dominion has vanished under the influence of Yankee notions and practices. But I don't blame the Yankees. The lottery, grudgingly approved, was the only thing Virginia offered my father in his waning days. But the northern states raised money. Donations came from New York, Baltimore, and Philadelphia, where William still lives. William sent money. Tried to, anyway. But these and all donations Papa refused, out of pride or fear that it had undermined the lottery. I burned William's letter of condolence, filled as it was with tender sentiments and an unwise insistence that I visit him. I don't trust myself to see him. I'm so unmoored of everything but grief, I don't trust myself or my virtue. And my virtue must be pristine, for my father's reputation, and what is imputed to it by mine, is an asset I use shamelessly. In the outpouring of national grief over my father's death, I see that Tom is given a public employment. Hopefully an income will restore my husband to his right mind. More importantly, it will keep him away. Milton, 6 August, 1827. From Thomas Mann Randolph to Septimia Randolph. I have loved your mother and only her with all my faculties for 35 years next December. I wish to spend some happy years yet in the decline of life with her. I am always reading letters now. My father's to me, mine to him, his to everyone else. Letters from his friends, condolences, tributes, poems. And now I'm reading another letter, having nothing to do with my father at all. A letter from Tom expressing his wishes to reconcile. I linger over the part where he writes, "He has loved me and only me." On its surface, a tender sentiment. But I know it's also an accusation. I loved Tom, but not only Tom. Not ever. And I feel no regret for that. Especially because Tom's declaration is to guard himself against divorce. My son-in-law, Mr. Coolidge, explains,
"I'm sorry to inform you that even in Boston the only grounds for divorce are consanguinity, bigamy, impotence, and adultery. None of which apply, I assume."
I flush, shamed to even be discussing it. But he continues,
"On the other hand, you may obtain a legal separation for cruelty or desertion."
Tom has certainly been cruel. And I'd argue that he deserted me, that he always deserted me in times of need.
But it's equally true that I've deserted him. I fled to Boston in the darkest hours of my grief, and now there must be an accounting for it. Tom will want to see his children, and I can't keep them from him forever. He would take them from me forever if I tried. Ellen's husband replies in his cool, flat Boston accent,
"You can keep the children from Mr. Randolph for a few years at least. Then they'll be too old for him to force to his will. Unless there are grounds for legal separation, there must simply be a separation of miles. Even if Mr. Randolph comes for the children, I can see to it that they're hidden away at some distance where he can't get them into his hands."
There seems something immoral about this scheme, as well as impractical. I married the man and gave him children. The law puts me completely in his power, even though he's destitute. As if sensing my hesitation, my son-in-law says, gruffly,
"You needn't fear him. From what I hear, Mr. Randolph is holed up miserably in a little house, with much liquor and without a second blanket for his bed. Nicholas Trist will keep him from Monticello, and I'll keep him from here."
Far from alleviating my fears, this strikes me as profoundly unjust. Tom, barred from Monticello, as unwelcome there as he was at Tuckahoe. Monticello is, until we can find a buyer for it, my home, and if it's mine, it must also be my husband's. That was always my father's intention. It was our vow to Tom, implicit and explicit. "I cannot countenance abandoning Mr. Randolph to poverty," I finally say.
"Then he'll take your money,"
is my son-in-law's harsh reply. In honor of Papa, the states of Louisiana and South Carolina have voted me $20,000 in bank stocks for my upkeep. Not enough to save Monticello, but perhaps enough to support those who depend upon me. It's a generosity I hadn't solicited, but which makes me the target of opponents who think me unworthy, as my father wasn't a soldier and I wasn't his widow. I suppose they believe I've done nothing and meant nothing to this country. It's a sentiment that has made me redouble my efforts to edit my father's papers, and it's made me think hard upon my own character. So long as property is vested in me and Tom is destitute, I must make some effort for his support.
"Surely you aren't thinking of returning to live as his wife,"
my son-in-law replies.
"He can make no mischief for you or the children in Boston, but I can't keep that animal away from you in Virginia."
Ellen winces, carefully turning her head so her husband doesn't see how calling her father an animal causes her distress. Whether it's for love or shame, I cannot say. I suppose I must now be beyond both love and shame. What matters now are my children, my grandchildren, and my slaves. There's an option that my son-in-law hasn't considered. One I learned from my father. Negotiation. And I'm my own best ambassador. So in the spring of 1828, I return to Virginia and step into the now dilapidated White House in Milton to find my husband drunk and unkempt in the middle of the day.
"Patsy?"
Tom asks, squinting at my appearance in the doorway, as if I were a hallucination. I want to be angry. I want to remember that this is the man who destroyed himself with resentments. The man who struck me and beat my children. The man who tormented me at my father's funeral. But when he tries to get up from a threadbare chair and his knees nearly buckle under him, I'm nearly undone with sorrow to see the ruin of him. I'm shocked by the sight of him, so pale and haggard. Truly shocked. He's so emaciated I cannot think he's had a meal in weeks. Why hasn't anyone told me how very ill he is?
Don't stand, I say, helping him back to his chair before he falls. Clutching my arm, Tom barks,
Why have you come?
I've come to have a frank discussion. I hurry forth with the rest, taking advantage of his astonished speechlessness. I can see that you're cold and hungry and suffering. You haven't a proper bath. And though you've come to this sorry state through your own stubbornness, understand that I'd never willingly leave you in poverty so long as I have a shilling in the world.
My stubbornness, Tom says, eyes bulging. What of your son?
You must give up this hatred of your own flesh and blood, I insist, strangely unafraid. Then again, what can Tom do to me?
He's as weak as a newborn babe.
Or do you want us to remember you the way we remember your father? Tom's once beautiful mouth thins.
That's all you want?
That's where it must start, Tom. If we come to an agreement, we may all reside together at Monticello until such time as it's sold away. It's an unfurnished place now. But it's better than keeping rats for friends, as you must be here.
What are you saying, Martha?
I'm saying that I want you to come home to your family. Of course, given your unsocial habits and hatred for the necessary restraints of civilized life, I assume you'd prefer a little establishment of your own on some sequestered spot of Monticello. He takes the opportunity I've given him to save face, but a bit too far as always.
I'd live entirely in my own room, making no part of the family and receiving nothing from it in any way whatever.
As you like. Though I'll insist he take food.
Tom's eyes narrow. What about Short?
No, I will not discuss William. It's better for both of us to drop a curtain over the past. There's enough warmth of heart between us to live in harmony, Tom. But upon such subjects as we cannot agree, we must be silent. He nods, and it's enough. Truthfully, seeing him in such a state, he could have refused all my terms, and it would still have been enough. Because I realize, even before my daughters and I get him settled into the North Pavilion, that he's afflicted by more than hunger. He complains of stomach pains and gout, and is so meek and softened of temper that I think he must be dying. My daughter Ginny is a disapproving sentinel at the door. Mother, your children shall have a right to interfere if things between you return to their former state. He won't be allowed to disturb your rest. I'm not tired or in need of rest, I say, because after 2 years of grieving for my father, I'm finally awakening. I said that I was sick but would be well again, and now it's come to pass. Would that Tom were as fortunate. I see to it that my husband has food and blankets and healthful teas and medicines to ease his pain. I sit by his bedside hour upon hour, day after day, reminiscing about the good times, of which we can both recount surprisingly many. One morning, Tom's eyes, bleak and teary, meet mine.
Did you love me, Patsy? Did you ever?
Oh, I did. I'm heartbroken by how easily the admission falls from my lips now. The young man who told me he preferred trees stripped bare of their leaves and kissed me so passionately in a schoolhouse. The young husband who tried to coax a slave girl's infant to suck at a cloth soaked in milk. The man who rode so hard, worked himself sick in the fields, fought for his country, and wrote poems to his daughters. Yes, I loved you, Tom Randolph. My throat tightens, and tears, real tears, roll down my cheeks. I loved you truly and deeply.
as if he's been waiting for my tears his whole life. Tom reaches out and touches the wetness, smooths it with the pad of his thumb.
Oh, Patsy, my adored wife.
He weeps. We weep together. And when we're done, he says,
"Send for Jeff. I cannot die without making friends with him. Cannot leave him in anguish as my father left me."
My heart fails at that. Jeff comes straight away. My husband asks for my son's forgiveness. And my tall, upright boy has the heart to give it. Tom has kind words for me and the children and the grandchildren. We nurse him, stroke his hair, hold his hands. His daughters surround the bed, fanning him of his fever during the day and his sons through the night. Tom gives some strange directions about his shrouding and burial, then takes them back, fearing they'll confirm the idea that he's insane. And he looks to me a bit fearfully as he asks to be buried not at Tuckahoe with his kin and his own father, but with my father at the head of his tombstone. "It's only fitting," I tell him, moved by this final request, even though I know it will put Tom eternally in the shadow of my father's monument, as he was all his life. Then Tom begs for Jeff to stay with him in his dying hours. All I want is for his suffering to end, and for him to die in peace with everybody, which is just what he does, on the 20th of June, without a struggle or a moan. My sons must dig the grave because my father's people have been sold off. I'm told the auction at Monticello was no less heart-rending than the sacking of an ancient city with children wailing and women rending their garments. And I feel as if I hear the echo of their anguish here. They're all long gone, except for Burwell, who continues from habit to tidy the empty house. Sally and her sons live in Charlottesville now, so I know better than to look for her at the gravesite. But once we bury Tom and make the slow walk home past Mulberry Row, my eyes drift to her old cabin, as if I expect to see her standing in the doorway in her apron, those amber eyes saying, "Now it's done. We've both buried our husbands now." And so we have. Every unkind feeling has been buried, too. No longer an object of terror or apprehension, Tom became one of deep sympathy. But the bonds of affection were so much weakened by the events of the last years of his life that after the first burst of grief is over, we cannot but acknowledge that all is for the best. Returning health would have brought with it the same passions and jealousies. The Randolph was quite beyond his control. It would have poisoned our family and our memory of him. His peace and good end is Tom's legacy. I'm afraid he has no other. The whole of his possessions amount to some $600 worth of books and a $20 horse. And it's left to Ellen to write an epitaph for him. Thomas Mann Randolph of Tuckahoe, Virginia, born 1768, died June 20th, 1828. He was a man of talent and of learning, charitable to the poor, a good son to his mother, and a kind father to his daughters. No father seek his merits to disclose, or draw his frailties from their dread abode. A fair and fitting tribute. I know of only one way to do him the basic justice Papa and I always wished him to have. Tom will be remembered, almost entirely, I think, through his letters to my father and my father's letters to him, of which I will shape every word. Chapter 43 Monticello, 1829 From Martha Jefferson Randolph to Ellen Randolph Coolidge. We are at present engaged in a business that precludes work, writing and reading of every kind but the one, revising and correcting the copies of the manuscripts. This is the last letter I'll write from Monticello. It's now a house of ghosts, dark and dilapidated with age and neglect. Bare trees loom like skeletal fingers in the yard, all pointing toward the heavens, where my father and his angels surely now reside. The hall, once filled with statues and natural curiosities, is empty but for a single bust of my father. Bare walls once covered with paintings, and a defaced floor no longer polished to a high sheen, open into the once gay and splendid drawing room, now comfortless. And yet, Monticello is still an attraction for tourists. A vulgar herd of strangers has stomped over the gardens, taking away my choicest flower roots, my yellow jasmines, fig bushes, grapevines, and everything and anything they fancy. I feel like a spirit of the place that has survived the death of its body, now deprived of even its purpose and going on because my father's papers are ready to publish. On the day the work is done, I somehow rouse myself from a cold bed to watch the last wagon load of books and papers packed into crates to be shipped away for sale. There will be no groundbreaking, no bugles blowing, no commemoration dinners for this patriotic monument. But I perceive in it an achievement, more than an achievement, a triumph, a secret triumph. For years now, sometimes for 8 to 10 hours a day, I've scoured every letter, every record book, every receipt and scrap of paper in my father's possession. I've burned some. In other instances, I took a razor to cut words away, just as my father once cut away what he believed to be untrue in the Bible. Eventually, I entrusted the political letters to my daughters, whose eyes were better suited to such work, and kept the personal letters for myself. In the end, the collection will bear my son's name as editor, but the work is mine, and I feel both gratified and damned by it. I must leave Monticello now, and I feel an unbearable sadness, such that I might be better off to lie down and die. After all, I cannot feel at home or happy anywhere else. And when I think of what might be done with the place, that it might be transformed into an inn or a boarding house, it seems like profaning a temple. I'd rather the weeds and wild animals that are fast taking possession of the grounds should grow and live in the house itself than see my father's home turned into a tavern. Indeed, there's a part of me that might be gladdened by the sight of the house wrapped in flames, every vestige of it swept from the top of the mountain. I'm there on the terrace, watching the man load up the wagon, wondering where I might get a torch to set Monticello ablaze, when I hear the jingle of a carriage coming up the road. More marauders, no doubt, come to chip off a piece of red brick from the house, or snatch away a broken rail as a keepsake. I don't turn to greet them. My eyes are for the men who lift each crate of my father's papers, as I warn them with crossed arms and an unfeminine scowl that their cargo is precious.
Patsy, you're going to catch your death standing here in the cold.
The voice pulls me from my dark thoughts. I know it intimately, and I turn to see a face at once familiar, beloved, and impossible. William!
I didn't mean to startle you.
He tucks a top hat under his arm, taking in a deep breath of cold mountain air.
Did you really think you'd never see me again?
In truth, I was sure I'd never see him again. And now I half wonder if he is only the conjuring of a mind bent with secrets and sadness.
You're shivering.
He removes his long, dark coat with its high shawl collar and wraps it around my shoulders. The warm brush of his hands against my neck nearly convinces me he's here.
I cannot invite you in to sit, Mr. Short, for there are no chairs. We close up today. Why have you come all the way from Philadelphia?
He cannot want a memento, though I'd find something to give him if he does, for he has as much right to a token of Thomas Jefferson as any man alive.
You cannot still have business in the area.
Urgent business,
he says with a meaningful stare.
I'm told there's an effort afoot to purchase Monticello for you, Patsy.
After all our struggles, there's some chance to keep Monticello? I'm afraid to believe it. There have been too many false hopes.
But who?
It isn't important to. What's important is that I've come to put a stop to it.
I can make no sense of this whatsoever. It's hard enough to credit that I have an anonymous benefactor, but nearly impossible to believe William would stand in the way of anyone helping me. Have I finally turned him so thoroughly against me?
It's been years since, in tearful confessions of love and longing, we said our goodbyes. But now he's here again, to witness my violent parting from this place. Has he come to take some pleasure in it?
No, I cannot think it of him.
But you were behind the donations from Philadelphia, I murmur, remembering the receipts I found in my father's papers. Money in your name, and more than that, too.
His eyes fall to his feet. Not enough, it would seem.
Much more than was expected of you, or Philadelphia, for that matter. I'm sometimes left to wonder why my father's own Virginia, which has most benefited by his talents and virtues, has given him a grave and left others to give bread to his children. And now all he built here will crumble to dust.
So what if it does?
William asks.
I startle, thinking I've misheard. But the grim line of his mouth tells me that I haven't. And I'm appalled.
You cannot mean that. I cannot believe that you, of all people...
This house isn't your father's greatest work. This is a plantation, and it ought to be abandoned. For it was, even at its height of beauty, built on ugliness.
How dare you, I say, wanting to slap him. Am I fated to have the men I've loved torment me in my weakest moments? Tears sting the corners of my eyes, my heart hammering painfully beneath my breast, much as it did all those years ago when he confronted my father in the woods. And William is no less relentless now. His words run over mine. This is a place impractical and cruel, and you, who were a guest here and enjoyed its benefits. He doesn't dignify my accusation with an answer.
He isn't here, Patsy,
William says, taking my arms.
How can you say that?
Emotion nearly strangles me. He's here, all around, his hand in everything.
He's gone. This isn't his home anymore. And it's not your home either. It's a set of chains.
His words reach me in places I have never let anyone reach. In places inside me that I don't even let myself touch. They recall to me a vivid memory of my childhood, and a rider who came up this mountain to warn,
Leave Monticello now or find yourself in chains. And William was there. He was there from the start. And so was I. I want to strike him, pound my fists upon his chest. And I do raise my fists to strike him, but my agony of spirit leaves me only the strength to lay them on his chest as I howl with anguish. And for the first time since my father's death, or perhaps even longer than that, I fall to pieces. In truth, I fall forward into William's arms, crying tears I dared not shed until the day I finished editing my father's letters. And now that I've done it, I have not even duty to hold me up. Lowering me to the stairs before I collapse, William whispers, "Abandon this place, I beg of you." My tears burst forth like a broken dam, first a trickle, then a pouring, and I scarcely recognize the sounds that come from me. I weep for the loss of my husband, for my children, for my sister and her babies, for Sally's children too. And I finally weep for my mother, whom I was too frightened to cry for when she died. I cry the unshed tears of a lifetime until I am quaking and limp and so frail I don't think I can rise ever again. "Let me take you from here," William whispers, his forehead pressed to mine. "It will be better for you. I promise you, it will be better for you to get free of it. It's the only way you can be happy." "Be happy. That's what I want for you." My mother spoke those words to me when she asked me to watch over my father. But somehow I forgot them. That command was swallowed up in the enormity of my dedication to my father. But now Papa is gone, and my vow has been discharged. All except for that. "Be happy." Remembering my mother's words, the ache somehow eases in the contemplation of leaving Monticello. "Where will I go?"
"Anywhere you please."
I don't know where I would go. I don't know what would please me, because I've never before asked. This is the first time I can. The first time I've ever allowed myself to even consider it. And I can't help but marvel at embracing my father's beloved ideal of self-determination for the first time at the age of 56. And as a woman at that. For now, all I know is that I wish to leave with William Short. Somehow I find within myself the strength to rise. We walk together from the terrace. At first, my steps are bent and painful. But the farther I walk, the less I feel the pull. Mindful of the cold muck on my feet, I straighten like the Amazon William always said I was. Like the Amazon I am. William hooks his little finger into mine, guiding me toward his carriage. But I pass it by. I look back once, then not again. I want to walk from this place. I want to run. Epilogue. Washington, 7 February, 1830. From Andrew Jackson to Martha Jefferson Randolph.
"The President of the United States thanks Mrs. Randolph for the cane she had the goodness to present him, with feelings of deep sensibility, as a testimonial of her esteem, derived from the venerated hands of her father."
I live now in Washington City with my daughter Jenny and her husband, who has taken a clerkship in the Jackson administration. We live in a rented two-story house with an excellent kitchen, beautiful fireplaces, and a large, cheerful room.